How often do you think about why a word or a particular phrase just exactly nails the thing you want to say? How about how that word or phrase conveys a way of thinking, a set of experiences, a worldview? How language can not only help you say what you want to say, but may even help shape what thought you have in the first place? If you've ever picked up another language or just learned a few phrases, maybe while traveling, you realize pretty quickly that a language isn't just a tool for saying stuff. It's a pretty remarkable living history of how humans in a particular place or places over time have chosen to express what matters to them and how they see the world and their place in it.
Snow, aputi.
Famously, Inuits have 50 words for snow. Although, I've got to say, as a native Minnesotan, we've got a pretty robust vocabulary for snow, too. French has masculine and feminine nouns, but no specific way that men and women should speak differently from each other, whereas Thai and Japanese do have specific ways that men should speak and women should speak, and that anyone should speak when talking to a superior or to an inferior. Chinese has specific terms for someone older or younger, Lao or Xiao, and also for who's oldest and youngest in a family, which would have been important in a system where the eldest male traditionally tended to inherit the family fortune and the mantle of family leadership. So it's not just brother, but older brother, not just cousin, but younger female cousin. And yet, in Chinese, there's just one word for third person, ta. No mention of he or she, older or younger, superior or inferior. You could probably add examples of your own, of how a language has values embedded in it. Each language has them, including endangered languages, and those make up a staggering half of the 7,000 languages on Earth. As the world becomes more connected, as the powerful impose their languages on the less powerful, or entice them with economic opportunities and convenience, ever more languages are disappearing. By the end of this century, many linguists estimate, at least half of the world's languages could be gone. Does that mean speakers of the powerful languages have won in this century? Or that we've all lost? This is Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstad. And when I was a foreign correspondent in East Asia for a couple of decades, I saw many examples of the power of language and the overpowering of languages. In Thailand, where I lived in the 90s, about a third of the 74 languages spoken within its borders are endangered. That's mostly due to the fact that if you want to make a living in Thailand, it helps to speak Thai. In China, where I lived for another 15 years, you've got that going on for sure, but you've also got a government that is leaning hard on people to speak the official national language, Mandarin. Only about 70% of people within China's borders do, because those borders weren't always where they are now. There are roughly 100 different languages spoken in China, from language families as different as Sino-Tibetan, Turkic, Hmong Mien, and Tungusic. The People's Republic of China has officially long celebrated the country's ethnic diversity, almost as a historical curiosity, while cracking down on cultural and religious practices the Communist Party doesn't like, and limiting or banning the use of minority languages in schools and workplaces, especially Tibetan and Uyghur, the Turkic language spoken in the western region of Xinjiang. To China's Communist Party leaders, the sense of a separate identity and way of thinking that comes through language is a threat to be squelched. One way the Chinese government has set about doing that is by encouraging Mandarin-speaking Han Chinese to move to the hinterlands, Xinjiang, Tibet, Inner Mongolia, which have long had their own language and culture. On a trip I once took to an ethnic Tibetan part of western China, Qinghai, I chatted with one such Han Chinese migrant. He said, "You Americans did the same thing. You pushed west and you took over. You made everyone speak your language. That's what powerful nations do." It is what we did. The fate of Native Americans and their languages is but one example of what's happened over time in many parts of the world. A powerful nation expands out, and with it, its language and culture, Europeans did it with colonialism, with varying levels of lasting impact. Many Africans now speak English or French. Most South Americans speak Spanish or Portuguese. China expanded out over centuries, absorbing dozens of ethnic minorities and languages and more than doubling the physical size of the country. America's expansion came in stages too, as did its impact. First, European settlers brought disease that wiped out millions of Native Americans. Then, American settlers pushed west and fought battles that wiped out many more and put the Native Americans who remained in reservations. No surprise, then, that many Native American languages are now endangered, spoken as a first language by dangerously few people. This is one of them, Potawatomi, spoken by a tribe of the same name from the Upper Plains Western Great Lakes region. They're connected to the Ojibwe or Chippewa.
This is sort of my rough translation, is where it lives, the Potawatomi language. So this dictionary is where our language lives.
This is Laura Welcher. She's a linguist who studied the Potawatomi language in grad school and is now head of operations at the Long Now Foundation in San Francisco. As the name suggests, the Long Now Foundation aims to foster long-term thinking and responsibility, very long-term. It's created a 10,000-year clock. But really, that's kind of a device to focus the mind on issues, challenges, and trends that will have their impact not just in our lifetimes, but in evolutionary time. I mean, think about it. It's only been about that long since humans started farming and changing the world in drastic ways, for better and for worse. The Long Now focuses on prospects and possibilities, both for better and for worse. Its Rosetta Project, which Laura Welcher directs, describes itself as a global collaboration of language specialists working to build a publicly accessible digital library of human languages. I sat down to talk with Laura in her Berkeley home.
Oh, I brought something to show you.
Oh, yes. So you're getting a very impressive pile of books on language here.
Yes, even though I am all about the digital mode now, I still have a small library of things that I just cherish. This is an issue of Language, which is the main academic journal for linguists in the U.S.
Journal of the Linguistic Society of America.
Right. And this is an issue published in March of 1992, where the first article is actually a position piece or a set of pieces that are talking about endangered languages. And this is pretty early on in my academic linguistic career that I encountered this article, and it really changed the field in so many ways because it sounded the alarm about languages going extinct, and it kind of raised the alarm among linguists. I mean, we study languages from all different kinds of aspects. Some of them don't involve a lot of descriptive field research, but it was trying to redirect the efforts in the field of linguistics so that more linguists would pay attention to languages that were becoming endangered and likely to go extinct, so that we would have some documentation of them before this happened. We know that there are about 7,000 languages out there. That's by a linguist's definition, by and large, so two languages being unintelligible with each other. So if two languages descend from a common ancestor and they diverge over time to the point where they're not mutually intelligible, then we call them two different languages. Mm-hmm. And these languages, they're coming from about 150 different language families, but it takes thousands of years for languages to diverge. Like, you know, the Indo-European language family took thousands of years to develop into the Indic languages and the Romance languages and so forth. So the languages that we're seeing, if you kind of take a snapshot of linguistic diversity on planet Earth, you're seeing this deep time of thousands of years for all of these languages. And we're seeing broad typological differences, very big structural differences. So you get these languages with really cool complex morphology, like Potawatomi, versus a language like Chinese, which doesn't have a lot of, or Mandarin, which doesn't have a lot of morphology, but has a lot of syntax, and they have tones, you know.
Okay, let me jump in here for a second. For non-language nerds, morphology is the study of shape. In this case, the study of how words are formed and of their relationship to other words in the same language. Syntax, you remember that from grade school grammar, right? It's the arrangement of words and phrases to create well-formed sentences, and also the rules, principles, and processes for doing this. Back to Laura.
So you see a lot of different stuff going on in languages around the world, but we're also seeing in the very near future a bottleneck where we know that many of the languages of the world, probably up to half of them right now, are threatened. And by threatened, I mean they are becoming moribund. They're obsolescing. People are no longer speaking them. So we can see the writing on the wall. We can see the future. And if nothing changes with these languages, they're going to continue to lose speakers. You're going to get to the point where the language has only a few elderly speakers left. And then when those speakers pass away, the language is going to go extinct.
So in its essence, language is about communicating. It's also an expression of culture and values and beliefs. It's a worldview. But there's sort of a pull that I've certainly seen in China where speakers of ethnic minority languages, particularly in southern China, are having a hard time having their kids stick around and learn the language because there are jobs in the cities. You need to speak Mandarin to be able to do those jobs. You know, kids leave at 18, 19 and go and live in the cities. And maybe they've learned some of the language growing up, but they're probably not going to teach their kids mm-hmm. much of that language. You know, the parents are sad about some of the customs not being passed on, but they're also happy that their kids are going to live a better life materially than they did. Mm-hmm. I had this experience talking to Tibetans in Qinghai. She said, look, you know, it's important for us to preserve our culture and our religion and our beliefs. And Lord knows the Chinese government has tried to curtail that. They're enforcing education in Mandarin. They're restricting Tibetans from being able to speak Tibetan in many different arenas. Same thing in Xinjiang. They're trying to have Uyghurs not speak their Turkic language as much, but have them speak more Mandarin and have them feel that they're more part of the greater Chinese population. So there's a sort of a push and pull at the same time, taking China as one example, but I think this is happening in many places. You know, the government's saying, oh, right now we only have 70% of the population in China who speak Mandarin. Within a few years, we want it to be 80%. And we think this is important for our political project to have everyone be able to speak the same language. At the individual level, some people feel that's oppressive. Other people feel it's convenient. Mm-hmm. You know, if I can speak the language that everyone else speaks, I can get work, I can travel, I can be part of this society. It's kind of the essence of the tension here, which is as you move into modern life, mm-hmm. particularly modern life that includes life online, one part of having a language is being able to communicate. Mm-hmm. It's enabling, right? And the other part is expressing how you see things. I mean, can you have both?
I think it's even more than that. And I think you're right. There's a lot of reasons for language shift. It just takes a generation for that shift to happen from being dominant in the heritage language to being dominant or fluent in the other language and then leaving the heritage language behind. I think it's good for everybody to have the freedom to make those choices. Parents wanting more opportunities for their children is a good thing, right? I don't think, even as linguists, that we have any right to go in and sort of dictate what people should be doing. You know, you should save your language. That's not our business at all. We're observers, we're helpers. But we know language shift does not happen in a vacuum. There are always discrepancies of power. And there are also questions or politics of identity that work into this, and sometimes very malicious ways. You know, we've seen this in our own country, our history. I've studied this a bit with my work with Native peoples, because we have a long history of cultural oppression with linguistic minorities here in the United States, especially with Native people, going back to 1600s, 1700s. At time of first contact, that's when you start to see this all play out. It plays out over centuries. With Native groups, before people were ever seriously in contact with Europeans, there were diseases that wiped out large groups of people. And then, you know, we have Andrew Jackson's policy of removal happening after centuries of disease and warfare and economic change, trying to get people to move west of the Mississippi. That happened to the Potawatomi. So forced removal from their homelands. And a language and a culture, you know, traditional ones are situated in a place. The language kind of documents the human experience of how to live in a particular place in the planet and environment and everything you need, all your technologies in that place. So to uproot a people and to move them is like cultural genocide. And that wasn't where it stopped. There are all of these assimilatory policies, like the removal of children from their homes and putting them into boarding schools. It didn't just happen here in the United States. It happened elsewhere in the world.
It's happening right now in China, doing it with Tibetans and Uyghurs and others.
And then all of the pressures that make people feel bad about their heritage language, right? That their language is backward. Or, you know, a lot of these languages are not written languages. Most human languages throughout human history were not written languages. In the modern world, many of us have experience with literacy, and we think that a language needs to be written in order to be a viable language, and that's not true. I've talked to people who think that they shouldn't try to preserve their heritage language because it's bad. It's, or it's illogical. You can't think in that language. It's not even written. But, you know, as a linguist, I know that is a full-fledged human language with millennia of history behind its development. And it's an expression of culture. And it's, I don't know, I think of languages as being repositories of art. It's ephemeral literature that's passed on from generation to generation. They're like our libraries. And they're like our encyclopedia. I think collectively, all of these languages are like the encyclopedia of how to live on planet Earth. And so with the loss of languages, what we're doing is basically tearing out most of the pages except for the M section of this encyclopedia and giving it to the next generation. That's what I fear we're losing. And then there's a real strong human rights question.
Because you've spoken about how the Universal Declaration of Human Rights includes language rights.
Mm-hmm. There is a declaration of linguistic rights as well. And one of the most powerful statements in that, it's actually hard for me to read it out loud because it says, you have the right to use your own name. I mean, I just think about that and I get like all choked up. You know, a lot of places people experience that they really can't use the name that they're given when they're born in their native language. That's horrible. If it weren't for the great power imbalances that exist in the world, if this was just kind of a free choice for everybody and people weren't being pressured or forced into making these decisions in some cases, then yeah, that decision is a reasonable one, I think, writ large. But that's not what's happening.
Do you think it's possible where there are only a few people speaking a language and where this has been an uncontacted group? There aren't so many left anymore in the world where they are contacted. They start to learn another language or multiple languages. I mean, is this kind of like where once you start to change your worldview because you've learned other languages and so you recognize there are other ways of seeing this thing that you saw, that that starts to encroach on the way that you speak your language? I mean, languages tend to evolve. They tend to absorb words from other languages. So, I mean, does that already start to erode what had existed, the worldview that's encapsulated in these languages that are spoken by relatively few people now?
Yeah, all languages have to change, all languages, or they die. So our world is changing. Our relationship to the world is changing. We need to keep our languages up to date to do that. And part of that is our experiences of interacting with other groups of people. And language contact or contact between groups of speakers of other languages and multilingualism is, you know, probably the norm. It's by far the norm in human experience. But what we're seeing now is different in that these languages are not becoming part of a larger multilingual ecosystem. What you see is that a new, more powerful language is becoming the target language for so many of these younger generations. So the next generation will gravitate to a language with greater power for economic mobility or the opportunities it provides. And then the heritage language is getting left behind.
As a linguist and as someone who's been deeply involved with the Rosetta Project, is your expectation that in trying to preserve some of these languages that otherwise might disappear, that there's then this repository of knowledge? Or are you hoping that there'd be a revival of interest in actually learning and using some of the languages that are endangered?
Yeah, well, I think for the people whose heritage languages these are, I think it should be a viable thing for them to be able to maintain their language or learn their language rather than not getting exposed to it or feeling like they have to abandon it to acquire something else that's going to give them more opportunity. I would like to see the world be a much more benevolent place for languages to thrive. But there's so many factors that work against that. And I was listening to your podcast. One of them is, who is we?
Who are we?
Yeah. That plays out with language in so many ways. The national identities. And we're seeing it happening in the United States now, where there's a real backlash against immigrants. And of course, there's a long history of this, as you know. You know, and back in the 1980s, 1990s, we saw a lot of backlash against the use of other languages besides English for official purposes. You know, a lot of states have enacted English-only legislation, a backlash against bilingual education that we've only recently overturned in California. So people target languages as a way to say that, hey, you're not assimilating, you're not part of our national identity. I mean, they feel it's a threat, but a world where multilingualism is not a threat, I think would be a beautiful human future. I don't know how to bring that about, but I have some ideas.
What's at the top of the list?
Well, I'm really interested in, because I have one foot in language technology, especially digital technology, I'm really interested in the future of electronically mediated communication. Basically, the communicating that we do with electronic devices, you know, whether it's on a computer or whether it's on a smartphone. I think that that's an incredibly important new domain of language use in the modern world. And if you look at the broad distribution of languages and who speaks what, it's a long tail distribution. So you've got like 95% of the population of the world speaks 5% of the languages, and 95% of human languages are spoken by 5%. When you look in the digital domain, you see that, but it's even more extreme. Like, you know, the top 10 languages are like 80% of what's online. And then the 20% of people have tried to figure out what languages those are, but we have an idea that probably there's some, at least minimal representation of different languages, whether it's tweets or web pages, in maybe 1,000 to 1,500 languages. So you can see that people are trying to figure out ways of using some of these long tail languages online. And many of those are going to be threatened languages. You know, you can still have language with million speakers, a few million speakers that are still threatened because they don't have state support or they're not used in the educational system or there are these other pressures against them or they can't be used online or they're not very viable. But the technologies exist for any language to be represented online. So would it be possible for us to make the online domain accessible for any speech community that wants to make use of it? For their own purposes, for entertainment or spreading news or for commerce, everything that we use the internet for. Maybe this is a bit of, I don't know, tech utopianism, but it would be my hope that there are advantages that the digital space has for languages, where in the physical face-to-face world, there are many factors that are working against these languages. But, you know, in the digital domain, you can cross physical divides, where the separation of speakers and diasporas, you can cross social divides. So like one teacher can reach out to many, many possible learners. And I've seen this happen with groups, the Potawatomi among them. They're very wired. They were wired back in like the 1990s, way more advanced than I was. And they really took to using the internet very quickly for assertion of their linguistic heritage. So you'd find like websites and Potawatomi and online classes. Now it's all over in social media, which is, I mean, so great to see. I'm seeing like new speakers emerge as a result of being able to connect online, because these are people who are in diaspora as a result of removal. They're like spread from Canada to Oklahoma, but they can connect over the internet. And so now, especially with smartphones becoming so widespread around the world, it makes it so much easier for people to access the digital domain, but can they access it in their language? Or does this become another domain of language shift where they have to switch to a more widespread, more powerful language in order to use this device?
Before we get into the Rosetta Project itself,
What got you interested in being a linguist? What drew you to that line of study?
So I grew up in suburban Detroit, you know, in the metropolitan area, in a suburb, which, you know, Detroit's a pretty segregated metropolitan area. I think that's changing some now, but when I was growing up, it certainly was. And, you know, my parents had left Detroit after the riots. And so I grew up out in the suburbs in what I thought was a very historically shallow place. I didn't have a sense of history there. And it wasn't until I got to be older that I realized, in fact, there was history there. There's a lot of different European immigrant communities that were represented just in my block. I just felt the sense of sameness everywhere and a real hunger for wider experience that I couldn't really get where the place where I was. It wasn't until I was able to go to college at the University of Michigan. I was so excited to go there. I thought this is my big chance to kind of explore the wider world. It was my freshman year that I took my first course in linguistics. I just happened to pick it. I fell in love with linguistics right then and there. I don't know if you remember this magazine called Games.
No.
I don't know if it's still published, but it was a magazine of puzzles. And the introductory course to linguistics, you're presented with all of these language puzzles that you have to figure out. And I thought, oh my God, I could do this for a living. That would be amazing. And I was also extremely lucky at the time that there was a course being taught not in linguistics or in the language departments, but in the American Cultures program there on the Ottawa language. So, you know, imagine my delight as a linguist, knowing that I could take a course in a Michigan native language. It would be like my first fieldwork experience in a classroom. I thought, that's awesome. I had no idea how it was going to be taught. I walked in on my first day, and I don't know if I've reconstructed this memory or if this is how it actually happened, but I remember our teacher, his name was Hat McHugh, sitting on the back of a chair with his feet on the seat of the chair, smoking a pipe. And he had, you know, a few assistants that had showed up with him. And there were a few linguists in there and a few kind of straggler liberal arts students. And then the rest of the class, like 50%, were football players because they heard it was an easy A class. It was one of the toughest courses that I've ever taken. You know, if you take it seriously.
So did all the football players not get A's?
They, you know, I think they got off easy. And I think that the teacher was very sympathetic to them. Mm. But the way he started off our first class is, you know, this is not going to be like any other language course that you've ever taken. Because there is no language lab. You can't go anywhere here on campus and listen to recordings of this language. He's like, there's no textbooks. He said, there is a dictionary. And I helped work on this dictionary, and so you guys should all order the dictionary. But the way you're going to learn is by coming to class and listening to me, and we're going to talk. And so that was my first experience kind of as a linguist, learning a language that was completely foreign to me. And it was wonderful.
So here is an example of a dictionary for the Ottawa language. This is...
But I love these words. So there's one... It's gush kwayasod, to be dizzy from the heat of the sun. And then there's gyuta jishing, I'm sure I'm slaughtering that, to curl up lying down, to lie curled up.
Mm-hmm. You have a lot of ideas that you can express in a single word. Mm-hmm. And because these languages do so much with the complexity of words themselves, these words are little packages of wonderful, wonderful ideas. So at the Long Now, part of my work there is director of the Long Now Library. And I've worked in archives, you know, linguistic archives in my academic career, but I'm kind of an accidental archivist. I'm, you know, I never went to school for library science or archiving. It's just kind of the experience that I've gotten through these other projects and the interest that I've had in trying to create better practices in our field.
So at the beginning of the Rosetta Project, Brewster Kahle, the founder of the Internet Archive, was involved. And, you know, it was like, how do we archive in a way that has the best chance of lasting a really long time? And you were talking about how paper's pretty good. I mean, acid-free paper can last, what, 500 years, 1,000 years. But then there's this thing called the digital dark age. You know, in fact, there's digital decay as well. So what is the Rosetta Project trying to do, or what has it already done? in terms of trying to find the best possible medium to ensure that you're trying to preserve a record of the languages, at least some component of the languages, so that people not just 50 years from now, but 1,000 years from now could look at them and say, oh, okay, I get how these fit together.
The Rosetta Project has these two sides to it. I mean, partly it is documenting human language, but it's also this effort at very long-term archiving. And we have developed an analog technology to record our language documentation. It's not necessarily the best of all possible solutions. It is a solution. But it's one that actually grew out of early conversations with Brewster Kahle. Before I joined the organization, a few years before, they'd held this workshop at the Getty Institute called Time and Bits. And Brewster was there, and many of our founding board members were there, and other people who were thinking about the problem of digital decay. And I believe that that's where Danny Hillis coined the term digital dark age. And that's the conversation that really kicked off the idea that the first entry in the Long Now library should be trying to address the problem of digital decay and how to do that. And Brewster Kahle suggested a technology that was in development at Los Alamos Labs, Los Alamos Government Lab. These two researchers were interested in the challenge of long-term archiving, because, of course, we're entrusting more and more of our data to the digital domain. But, you know, a website lasts, what, 100 days? And everybody's had the experience of catastrophic data loss in their own lives. But, of course, we're also entrusting lots and lots of data in our academic disciplines and our government records, all kinds of archiving that we're doing in the digital domain.
This prototype I'm now holding in my hand has micro etchings, or I think the idea was that the Rosetta disk would have micro etchings, preserving at least some of a language on metal in a way that was observable with a strong microscope, I guess, to have parallel for a particular word. And I think you guys chose verses 1 to 3 of Genesis, something that would be familiar to a lot of people in different parts of the world, not everywhere, obviously. So not unlike the original Rosetta Stone, where there were Egyptian hieroglyphics and Greek and then another form of Egyptian, I think. Mm-hmm. And you could say, okay, so these are all saying the same thing. And so I get a sense of what the construction of the language is to say this thing.
Mm-hmm. So we're trying to develop some kind of archival medium that could last for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And digital data, digital archiving is great for certain things. It's great for discovery. If you archive purposefully or develop an infrastructure that allows you to get into the data and make it searchable. So discovery, dissemination, and that's one of the principles of long-term archiving too, is, you know, if people can access it, if they can reuse it, that helps data live into the future. The bad linguist practice of like keeping all your data in a shoebox on your shelf, that's working against data longevity. Or, you know, not migrating your reel-to-reel tapes onto some other storage medium. But digital, of course, has its own problems, because if you migrate from, you know, my tape recordings that I put onto floppy disks or CDs, you know, CDs don't last forever. Or even if you put them onto your own hard disk and then you have a catastrophic failure of your hard disk with no other copies, you're going to lose that, right? So digital data has all of these benefits to it, but it also has all of these vulnerabilities.
So you have to stay vigilant and just keep backing up in the latest form available, plus back up in multiple different places.
Yes. Yeah, and Kevin Kelly, who's on the board of the Long Now Foundation, has a really great word for this called movage, right? And so it's like, you know, with physical stuff, we have to worry about physical storage, you know, and you have big libraries full of stacks of books to hold all of your knowledge. But in the digital domain, storage is less of an issue, especially with Moore's Law. It's getting easier and cheaper to store things all of the time. Where we are putting our resources now is in movage. In developing the Rosetta solution, or a possible solution to the digital dark age, we didn't want to abandon digital storage altogether because of those advantages, but we needed some way to have a backup that didn't have those vulnerabilities. It was Brewster Kahle who suggested to us this technology that was developed at Los Alamos Labs. And I think one of the possible applications of it at the time, as far-fetched as this might seem, was documenting
nuclear waste storage facilities. And they had a mandate, have a mandate, to store that information for 10,000 years. So what?
Which is as long as the long now clock is trying to keep time.
Exactly. So that was convenient for us. They had a real problem to deal with, and they had come up with a technology that could possibly last that long. And to describe the technology, it starts in a digital format where you collect all of your data, whether it's texts or images. So you organize a file that you make into a large image or a composite image of all of your data. Think of a microfilm, right? Mm-hmm. You have lots of pages in a very small format on a microfilm, microfiche, I guess. So this technology took the digital data, made that kind of composite image, and then using technology that was developed for the creation of microchips, would etch microscopically onto a silicon wafer. But, you know, instead of making a circuit, they etched letters and diagrams and pretty much anything you wanted that was basically like black and white. And your text would then be inscribed into this silicon wafer. And if you do it with a focused ion beam, the one that we were using was gallium ion beam, you can make it very, very tiny. You can actually etch to the point where you would need an electron microscope to be able to read it. But making the data accessible over the millennia, we wanted to make it legible with optical magnification up to 1,000 power. We felt that that was probably within the reach of societies, even ones who maybe had gone through a dark age. And it's been around in Western society, at least for hundreds of years. You know, if you can fix bad human eyesight, basic optics, then you can construct something to read it with. So after etching the silicon wafer, we electroplated with nickel, which was tested by Los Alamos Labs. It could withstand high heat up to, I think, 300 degrees centigrade, and also could withstand a saline environment. So, you know, you could be near an ocean or drop it in an ocean, and it's not going to corrode, and it's not going to rust. What you end up with after you electroplate, it's kind of like embossing. So your text is actually raised up off of the surface of this thin sheet of nickel by a few microns. And you shine a light on it, you know, with your microscope, it creates shadows around the letters. So you're actually reading shadows.
And you actually sent one of these into space.
Yes. So we were contacted by the European Space Agency many years ago. They were developing their own Rosetta project, their own Rosetta mission. And I think probably what happened is they were Google searching their name, and then the Rosetta project popped up. And they thought, I suppose they thought, well, this is kind of cool. This is like the next Voyager disk, right? You know, what if we put one of these on the craft that we're developing? So the project that they're working on there, the Rosetta mission, was to send a craft out to orbit with a comet. And there was going to be an orbiting craft, and then a lander would separate from that and actually go down and land on the surface of a comet, which is just this extraordinary technological feat. They caught us right before they were set to launch. We were in development of the Rosetta disk, just experimenting with the technology, and it was a scramble to put this together. But we developed the first prototype in time for the launch. And the first prototype had a disk that was about 8 centimeters across and had about 7,000 pages of language documentation on it. And they installed it on their craft, and then they blasted it into space. The mission decided that they were going to take the orbiting craft itself and try to control land it onto the comet. They weren't going to leave it in orbit. They were going to actually try to land it to get more data from its descent, knowing that when it landed on the surface, they were going to lose all contact with it. So that's what they did. I think it was 2016. They had a controlled descent of the orbiting craft, and they were in touch with it, getting data off of it until it went silent. We assumed that it landed, we don't know, roughly or softly, but it's down there on the surface now with a Rosetta disk on it. So a Rosetta disk is now on the surface of Comet P67 out there orbiting the sun.
Underlying the premise of having a disk like this is the concern that there might be some cataclysmic event whereby there won't be in living memory
the knowledge of these languages, mm-hmm. you know, sort of almost a apocalyptic Planet of the Apes kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, was that part of what was behind the idea of let's etch this in metal so, you know, it can be thrown into a desert or it can survive in the ocean? And hopefully at some point, somewhere in the distant future, someone will know that we once existed and this was what we said to each other.
Yeah, I've talked to many people who think that the project is apocalyptically minded. And my answer to that is, you know, I'm always thinking about the future recipient of a Rosetta disk or the future discoverer of a Rosetta disk. And I'm designing for a human. And I don't know if thousands of years in the future, our society will have undergone collapse, maybe several collapses. I mean, we know that's happened in the past. I think it's reasonable to think it might happen in the future. Maybe not. In either case, whether it has or whether it hasn't happened, I think that this would be an incredible thing to find. If I were a linguist of the future, I would be ecstatic to discover one of these, right? I'm leaving an artifact for, you know, the future that I would want to find. And maybe it won't be a linguist that finds it, but a linguist didn't find the Rosetta Stone either. It was Napoleon's soldiers, and they got it to a linguist.
So in terms of what's on the real Rosetta disk,
so I have to start by explaining we have different prototypes of the disk. We call them all prototypes because, you know, we're always kind of tinkering with it and seeing what's a better version of it. And the first prototype had around 14,000 pages documenting around 1,000 human languages. And by documentation, I don't mean deep documentation on any given language. We have a broad, very shallow collection because we were trying to get examples of the language that fell into different categories. So we wanted to have the same text for as many languages as we could find. We wanted to have a parallel vocabulary, the same set of vocabulary words for all of these languages. We wanted kind of snapshots of grammar. We wanted to talk about the writing systems so that we would have a very broadly parallel collection, just like the Rosetta Stone had parallel inscriptions, and that enabled the decipherment of Egyptian hieroglyphics. So we're thinking that in the future that this might be the key to understanding any given human language that might leave written records behind. So the first prototype that we made had 14,000 pages, and we had different versions of that. This wearable disk has 1,000 pages, and that's because we physically reduced the size of it to be wearable. So the first one we had fits in the palm of your hand. This one you can wear around your neck. The other new thing on this version of the disk is we started with all digital text. The original Rosetta disk collection we built up by scanning. This is before any of the big scanning projects. We had hand scanners and we're going into libraries and getting just snippets of text about the grammar of the language or keying in vocabulary words. But it was mostly image-based. And this version of the disk, I was able to keep all of the text as live and editable text. And the content on it is a little bit different from the original Rosetta disk. The parallel text that we use for this version is the preamble of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Oh, yeah, nice.
I really wanted to have the full declaration on there. And, you know, as a linguistic text, it's a little weird because it's declarationese. So, I mean, it wouldn't be my first choice for the purposes of language documentation, but for the purposes of having a parallel collection, it turns out I could find, you know, about 400 of these texts. And I couldn't fit them all because it's a long declaration, but I could fit the preamble.
Is the Rosetta Project trying to be a platform, like, let's say, there's a group, you know, where there are a few hundred people or a few thousand people who speak a particular language and they'd like to try to have a presence online. Can you guys help them with that?
Mm-hmm. So the digital archiving side of Rosetta, we don't have deep documentation on any language, but we do have some documentation for many of the languages of the world. There's another sister project to Rosetta at the Long Now Foundation called PanLex. They're taking a really interesting approach to this. They're trying to build a huge database of all of the words in all of the world's languages culled from bilingual dictionaries. You know, most languages don't have bilingual dictionaries or very many of them. So what the PanLex project enables, let's say you have an English to Swahili dictionary and you have a Swahili to, think of another language of the region,
Kanuri.
Okay,
so let's say you have a French to Swahili dictionary and a Swahili to Kanuri dictionary. Then all of a sudden, if you kind of link up these dictionaries, then you can go from Kanuri to French. And maybe from French, you could go to Mandarin. Or from French, you can also probably go to Potawatomi. It's a little lexicographically crude in that we're using the headwords of bilingual dictionary entries. We're not breaking down the morphology. We're not kind of pulling apart into its component pieces. It's just we're saying there's an equivalence here. But one of the cool things is if you build up lots and lots of these connections in the network, then you can start tracing best fit paths between different languages.
Some languages have a very specific word for a very specific thing that takes you like 10 words to say in another language. So then it's like a rough approximation.
It's very rough. And if you wanted to use it, for example, for like a broader translation of, say, a sentence or a phrase, it's going to come out kind of like a weird pigeon because you're not trying to do anything with the morphology of these words. But there have been some studies done on Panlex translations, even in these longer sentence-like formats, and people can kind of figure it out. So it's crude. Yeah, it's way crude. But for a lot of the languages of the world, this may be the only translation resource that exists. From the Panlex project, we have about 600 parallel vocabulary lists of about 100 to 200 words. So the same words in all of these different languages. And those are the two main parallel language collections that we have on the disk. But a dictionary, any dictionary is only one piece of language documentation. You know, if you're going to at least cover the bare bases, as a linguist, you would want a dictionary. You would want a grammar. I brought some grammars here if you want to take a look. And then a text corpus. And the way you can kind of think about these three things and how they work together is like if somebody gives you a recipe and says, this is how you bake bread. Mm-hmm. You would have your list of ingredients. That's your dictionary. You would have like preheat your oven to so many degrees and bake it for 45 minutes or whatever. That's how you put all your ingredients together into this piece. That's your grammar. But if you'd never followed this recipe before or had it, how would you know if it turned out right? So you would want to have tasted the bread before or some example of what a good loaf of bread is like. And that's your text corpus. You have real examples of language in use. The more examples, the better. That's your bread. Those three things together are the basics of language documentation. And using those, people have revitalized languages that have gone extinct and brought them back into modern use. Of course, you know, the language is going to change when you do that, maybe a lot, but it has that heritage and it has that pedigree.
What's a language that's happened to?
Well, a favorite example among people who work in Native North American languages is Miami, and it's related to Potawatomi. A colleague of mine, fellow academic from Berkeley, went through a lot of the old documentation from explorers and missionaries and early anthropologists and collected everything he could on Miami and then wrote his dissertation, basically reconstructing what the language was like. So you have a corpus, and if you can kind of bring that corpus into the modern world, you know, kind of standardize it, you have something that's searchable. You have a lexicon that you can build out of that, and he basically wrote the grammar. Well, Darryl Baldwin, and I've had the great experience of hearing him speak about this a few times in my career, he encountered this, and he's of Miami heritage. And when he first encountered it, reading this linguistic dissertation was, foreign. How do you even, you know, you need an instruction manual just to read the dissertation, right? Because it's a technical thing. But he wanted to learn it so very badly that he got a degree in linguistics and set about studying it as much as he could with the purpose of revitalizing it. He wanted to bring it back into modern use. And the Miami language, I think the last fluent speaker passed away, I might be wrong, but I think it was in the 1960s. So Darryl became a linguist and also started raising a family. And he created an environment within his family of linguistic immersion, using the language as much as he could with himself, with his wife. And they started speaking it to their children so that their children were growing up as fluent speakers of the language. So Daryl was a second language speaker of something that was reconstructed. And he was raising first language speakers as children. And what we know about children in this kind of a context, it has happened periodically around the world. This is where we get Creoles from, for example. The children started fleshing out the language and making it a full-fledged language that they could talk about anything they wanted to with. Is it a different Miami from the one spoken in the 1960s or even, you know, hundreds of years before? Sure it is. It is. But there's a continuity there. I mean, if you look at kind of like all of the changes that have happened to English, the English we're speaking now is not Old English even, it's not Middle English. And it looks like there's a lot of French in there and, and Latin and Greek. So Miami went through this period of great contraction. There's a lovely term for this, which is a sleeping language before it's revitalized.
So I have a mischievous question. You know, there have been times in modern history, certainly in living memory, when at least some people thought it would be a great thing if we all spoke one language. So Esperanto, for instance, which didn't go very far. There was a big series that the BBC did in the 1980s, The Story of English, which was, isn't it great that, you know, all around the world, so many people are speaking English, and so it gives people a common language through which they can trade and they can travel and so forth. When you hear things like that, how do you as a linguist feel about it?
Wow, wouldn't it be great if we all spoke one language? Sure, what if it's Canary? Why is it always, you know, it has to be English or it has to be Mandarin, you know? Because that is, you're privileging a language that has great power, right? But there are certainly advantages to having second language speakers, a lot of second language speakers of a language, you know, a language for international communication or commerce or trade is a very useful thing. And that's why English is so widespread as a second language. Mandarin's still more widely spoken both as a first and second language. But English kind of makes up its ground for not having as many native speakers by having more second language speakers. But, like, you know, they're not always going to be in those positions. Powerful languages have waxed and waned over the years, right? You know, we're not speaking Latin like we used to.
Yeah, we're not even speaking French like we used to. I mean, when I took it in high school, you know, it was like, this is the language of diplomacy. No, right. not so much.
German used to be the language of science and the arts, you know, not anymore. So if you kind of play this out almost absurdly and say, yeah, what if we are all speaking the same language? Is that even possible, even as a second language? And I maintain that it's not. And even if the linguists' worst fears come true, and let's say we're left with 500 languages in 100 years, those languages should continue to change. You know, they're going to continue to evolve. And what we know about humans is that language is a very important marker of identity and group membership and who you are, who you interact with, who we are in your sense of we. And that means that humans will always work to both preserve and accentuate linguistic differences. Mm. And the linguistic differences we have in the past are partly due to people being less easily connected with each other for a variety of reasons, you know, physical distances, geographic barriers like, you know, mountainous regions or a river or being on an island or cultural practices that reinforce language use for one reason or another. But this added factor of human identification with their culture and their language as being part of who they are, and the fact that languages are always changing. If they're not changing, they're dying, right? Means that, let's say we're only speaking Mandarin, you know, there's going to be like 1,000 different Mandarins.
You need only go into a pub in Glasgow to realize that you could both be speaking the same language, and it's, from one side, it could be unintelligible. I certainly have had that experience.
Yeah. World Englishes, right? You know, other nations that have adopted English as a national language, or, you know, one that's just absolutely widespread. I've heard some that I don't understand. Yeah, even if we're speaking one language, we're not really speaking one language. So we'd still have to wait probably several thousand years if you want to see, like, the differentiation that we're seeing even within a language family. And more than that, you know, if you'd want to see the typological variation that we're seeing in the world today. You know, we're in this moment in the 21st century when we're kind of at the last period, I think, unless dynamics change drastically, where a population of 100 speakers, a few hundred speakers, or even a few thousand speakers, like Papua New Guinea has 800 languages or more, spoken by very small groups of people. And for most of human history, that was a perfectly healthy language, mm-hmm. right? Because people were divided up by all these boundaries. But it's really hard to maintain that in the modern world. So we're at this kind of precious moment where we can take a snapshot of that. And I think it's inevitable we're going to lose a lot of the long-tail languages for all of the reasons that we've been talking about. And I think we are going to see a contraction in the number of languages. But I think if we work on making the world a better place for language diversity and multilingualism, a place where languages can thrive, maybe we'll still have a lot of different languages out there. And that's good for so many different reasons. And so there are people all over the world who are working to document languages as best they can, linguists, trained linguists, working with speech communities to develop the resources like a speech corpus, you know, recorded speech corpus, dictionaries, grammars, pedagogical materials, and also to then deposit them in archives so they can be accessed in the future by other linguists, by members of the community that want to do things with the resources there. It is a big part of the field of linguistics now. And I think it's also very good for the field because it brings linguists closer to their data. So the work that they're doing in theorizing and thinking about language, and also the firsthand experience of collecting that data. Mm. When you're working at 3 degrees separation from some published data, then it's very easy for your theories to drift from reality.
Well, yeah. In this case, it feels like you're racing the clock. Like this is a vitally important thing to be doing right now.
Yeah. But, you know, despite how vitally important it is, even if we had 10 times the linguists to go out and do this, no amount of language documentation or archiving can save a language. And with the Rosetta Project, we have a lot of language documentation for the languages of the world, but for any one language, we don't have that much. Certainly nothing that would even be considered adequate documentation of a language. We have a snapshot. These more elaborate language documentation projects can build up a bigger corpus and more documentation, more description, but in and of themselves, they're not going to save the language. The only way to save a language is for the community of its speakers to keep speaking that language. The archive of any language is its speakers and nowhere else.
So if you speak an endangered language, keep talking. If your parents or grandparents or neighbors do, and you care about keeping it going, learn it. You've got the Miami tribe as an example of one group that showed what a little applied effort can do. In fact, here's Daryl Baldwin, the guy who brought his kids up speaking Miami as a native tongue.
Aya, kinwalanisia wains wa'ane, nila miamia miamiata wa'ane.
Here he's speaking Miami in a video he posted online. And here he is talking about why revitalizing this language matters.
Through our work, we've seen profound improvements in youth identity formation, cultural competence, community engagement, and a general strengthening of intergenerational kinship bonds. We all seek to belong and to feel safe. And so for myself, speaking my language connects me to an ongoing human experience that is generations old.
I can offer another example of what a little proactive interest in a fading language can do. My great-grandparents grew up on the rugged western coast of Ireland, in Connemara, speaking Irish, a form of Gaelic. Many Irish speakers from that impoverished region left Ireland, including my great-grandparents, and others moved to the cities of Ireland, where they needed to speak English to make a living. By the 1980s, Irish was an endangered language. But then, within Ireland, came a revival of interest in Irish culture, including the language. And now, about 40% of Irish in the Republic of Ireland say they can speak at least some Irish. That's 1.7 million people, though only about 70,000 say they speak it every day. The Irish government aims to more than triple that number over the next decade. But even now, this young interviewer posted a video on YouTube showing that you can find a fair number of young Irish who can speak at least some of the language.
Hi, I'm Claire, and this is Seeing If Irish People Can Speak Irish. Jigwish Connie Constashev.
Tom Igama.
Agus Amil Shavig Stager.
Sha.
Amil Gilgagot.
Biogani.
Oh, Intok. Agus Constashev Jane Avenue.
Sha. Shane.
Dol called my brother Grahara Ekoil. Agus Anshin Ta Rong Piano Ago.
Amil Gilgagot.
Ta Glor Gilgagum Sha.
Intok. Agus Statue Stager Gilgagot.
Tom Mivlin the Cook Filar, Beme Drastel Air Skull Katrina, Lahidlina Shea, Agus.
Language is both a tool and a treasure, and in using what's practical in the moment, it's good, I think, that at least some people realize how precious the language of their ancestors is, not at all something to be ashamed of or to discard in the name of progress. A wealth of knowledge is embedded in each language, and in this century and those to come, with all the challenges we'll be facing as a human race, we can use all the help we can get. That's it for this time. Thanks to Laura Welcher of the Long Now Foundation and the Rosetta Project for her time and insights. You can learn more about the Rosetta Project at rosettaproject.org and about the Long Now Foundation at longnow.org. In this episode, Laura mentioned one of my earlier episodes, Who Are We? That's we with quotation marks around it. It's about the question of who gets to say who belongs and who doesn't in a globalized world. And it's a case made by Chandran Kukuthas, who heads the London School of Economics Department of Government, for more open borders. Interestingly, that got trolled a lot when it came out just before the 2016 election. Now I wonder how many of those snarky comments were from Russian troll farms. There was also a mention in this episode of the Internet Archive, which aims to make multiple copies over time of what appears on the Internet. Its Wayback Machine is an open and free resource accessed by more than 500,000 people a day. You can check it out at archive.org. And you can hear more about it in an earlier episode of Whose Century Is It? Called The Badass Librarians of the Internet Archive. These and all episodes of Whose Century Is It? Are at whosecenturyisit.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Back soon with another episode.